Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining the session. My name is Adarsh Shah. I'm coming to you from New York. That's one of the benefits of having virtual conferences. You can be part of the conference from anywhere in the world. Today, I'm going to talk about principles, patterns, and practices for effective infrastructure as code. This session is based on my experience working with infrastructure as code over the years and helping various companies adopt best practices. So let's get started. I'm sure you all know what infrastructure as code is, so I'm not going to spend much time on the definition, but just wanted to mention that it is one of the key DevOps practices that enables teams to deliver infrastructure and the software running on it rapidly and reliably at scale. First up, let's talk about key principles that everyone using IACE should be aware of. Idempotency helps in simplifying the provisioning of infrastructure and reduces the chances of inconsistent results. No matter how many times you run your IACE and what your starting state is, you will end up with the same end result. Idempotency can be achieved by using a stateful tool with a declarative language like Terraform, where you define the desired end state of infrastructure you want, and then it is Terraform's job to get you to that end state. If it can't get to the desired state, it'll fail. Let's now compare non-idempotent and idempotent code. So as you can see on the left, that if you want to provision three VMs, you write your code, you run your code to provision your three VMs that you want. But then let's say you reapply that same code again. In case of non-idempotent code, you will get six instead of three expected three VMs. Now, of course, you can write conditional logic where you can check for the state of how many VMs are there before provisioning it again. But again, you have to take care of all that logic. While on the right side, as you can see, in case of idempotent code, again, if we want to provision three VMs, we write our infrastructure as code, we provision them, and then if we reapply, it actually doesn't change anything. It doesn't provision any new VMs because it knows that the three VMs that are expected are actually already there. So in the second case, you use a declarative language, you define the desired state, and then it's the tool's job to make sure that you get to the desired state, the tool or the code that you write. Okay. The second one is immutability. Immutable infrastructure means instead of changing an existing infrastructure, you replace it with new. By provisioning new infrastructure every time, you are making sure your code is repeatable, the provisioning is reproducible, and it doesn't allow for configuration drift over time. Now, configuration drift is a huge problem with infrastructure. It occurs when over a period, there are changes made to infrastructure that are not recorded and your various environments drift from each other in ways that are not easily reproducible. This usually happens if you have a mutable infrastructure that lives for a long time and causes issues. The system is more brittle in general for long-lived infrastructure, since issues like slow memory leak, disk out of space due to log accumulation, etc., might occur over a period. It also means that you won't be provisioning the infrastructure as frequently as your applications or configuration, and as a result, won't be confident in your ability to do so. These issues can be resolved by using immutable infrastructure. So let's look at the difference between mutable and immutable infrastructure. So as you can see on the left, you write your IACE code and you provision V1 of your infrastructure, right? Version 1 of your infrastructure. And then let's say you make some changes. You might be changing stuff that's installed or deployed to your VMs. And then once you make those changes, you apply those changes again, and it kind of deploys, it makes changes to the same VMs that you provisioned and applies those changes that you made. So as you can see, the V1 and V2 version of your infrastructure, they both were, the changes were done on the same infrastructure, same VMs in this case. While on the mutable side, as you can see that you're in the same state where you provision those three VMs, and then your users are hitting those VMs. Now, again, you make those changes and you have your V2 version of your infrastructure. In case of immutable infrastructure, it actually provisions brand new infrastructure. In this case, three new VMs with version 2 of your infrastructure. And then the user traffic starts redirecting to V2 version of your infrastructure. And then you eventually get rid of V1 version of your infrastructure. So as you can see here in the immutable case, you get brand new infrastructure every time you make change. This way, you avoid issues like configuration drift and other aspects over a period of time. It also gives you more confidence in your code base. Okay, so now let's talk about patterns and practices that have worked for my teams and me over the years working with infrastructure as code. So it goes without saying that everything should go in source control, even a script that you run occasionally to fix an issue. I have been at places where no one knows where a script that runs in production lives, who created it, and history of changes. This is a situation you don't want to be in. It's really painful, especially finding and troubleshooting issues in production. The second aspect is make sure the code is accessible to everyone in the company. Even for developers that don't make changes to the ISE code base, make that code available. And I understand there might be exceptions like legal reasons or privacy reasons where you don't want to have the code accessible to the entire org. But otherwise, make it visible to everyone. This gives visibility and a better understanding to those who run their applications on your infrastructure. So when your consumers want to troubleshoot an issue and want to understand how infrastructure was provisioned, they can easily do that by looking at the code. They should be able to look at the code, understand how the infrastructure is provisioned, and even contribute if they choose to do so. I have worked with teams where other teams, team members create pull requests and get it reviewed from the team that owns the code and get it merged because they want that fix done. There are also places I have seen where these ISE repositories are not accessible to the rest of the organization, but they also store that code in a totally different tool, source control tool, that makes them hidden. This is an anti-pattern. Move away from that. Modularizing ISE, like software code, helps with maintenance, readability, as well as ownership. It also helps in keeping the changes small and independently deployable. You can modularize your code and version them, and then deploy those individual components and kind of upgrade the versions of your modules as and when needed, so that you have better control over those. Refactoring ISE is relatively difficult compared to software, especially for critical pieces like DNS records, CDN, network, databases, etc. So being biased towards over-abstraction upfront works better, even though that means dealing with slightly more complex ISE than needed. So this last part that I mentioned about refactoring is actually based on some of my experience working with networking and other aspects where changing a CIDR range or other aspects are not as easy. You might have to actually reprovision the infrastructure and destroy the existing one. And in some cases, especially for networking, if you're sharing your networking across multiple teams and things like that, it's not as easy. So yeah, coming back to maintenance, yeah, it's better to kind of have those modularized and versioned code so that it's easy to maintain. Readability also is better in case where you modularize your code, because you exactly know that each module is responsible for a certain thing, rather than have huge modules or have code files that are large. And now this is, ownership is another important aspect, where especially if you're working as part of a bigger enterprise where you have various teams that own various aspects or various parts of your code base or infrastructure, it helps if you modularize your code better, it helps with ownership. Let's look at a quick example here. I'm not going to go talk about this in detail, but here's an example of typical infrastructure layer for an AWS setup. And as you can see on the left, the ownership of those layers by various teams, like platform engineering team, security, networking team, or application team. So your various layers of your infrastructure, and thereby infrastructure as code and various modules, can be owned by various teams. I have a detailed article that actually explains this slide in more detail if you want information, and I have included that link to the article towards the end of this presentation if you want to have a read. Documentation. So first of all, there is a misconception that with ISC you don't need any documentation. Agreed that with, if you use ISC, you need less documentation as you're codifying all your changes, but you still need documentation for troubleshooting, playbooks, onboardings, etc. I have seen a few folks also generate documentation from ISC, which can be helpful. And I understand documentation is hard, but it is necessary. Just like with code, make sure that you have just enough documentation to convey the message you want. More documentation doesn't mean it's better. Out-of-date documentation is even worse. So let's look at some of the kind of practices. First, make your documentation easily available. For example, if you are displaying an error, it's a good idea to include a link to the documentation to troubleshoot issues like that. Also have runbooks for typical scenarios like troubleshooting issues during production outage. Next one is keep it updated. So like I mentioned, out-of-date documentation is worse. It's actually worse than not having documentation, because at least in case where you don't have documentation, you'll try to find the answer by talking to someone or looking at the code base. But if the documentation is out of date and gives you wrong information, there are more chances you'll just accept it as it is. So here's another one which in my experience has helped keep documentation up to date. Keeping documentation closer to the code, there are more chances you will update it. So here's an example where, let's say you're using GitHub as a source control and you have repos which has readmes. What we have done in the past is, as part of your pull request process, have a checklist, and the person who's actually reviewing the code will make sure that you have updated all the documentation if you have readmes as part of your repos, rather than having in some wiki that's external to the code base. So, I mean, that is something that I have seen. Folks tend to update that the documentation more often if it's closer to the code and you can have better checklists. And I understand you might have external wikis. Provide a link to your documentation in GitHub so that folks can even search for that documentation in your wiki. like in software development, you need to think about testing, especially automated testing for your infrastructure's code. This diagram is my attempt at test pyramid for ISE. So the idea here is that, as you can see on the left, that as you go up the pyramid, your cost and duration for those tests keep increasing. Same thing, brittleness and maintenance go up as you go up the pyramid. And we look at it why. So let's start with the bottom, where you have static analysis. If you're using Terraform, running things like Terraform Validate and tflint that lints your Terraform and validates that it's valid even before you run the plan or init, is gives you faster feedback. I would recommend you running those even as part of your IDE if you use one. Same thing with Puppet. You have Puppet parser validate. Next one up is interesting, the unit test, where typically when you're writing declarative code, let's say Terraform again as an example, you're already defining the desired state, and it's Terraform's job to get you to that desired state. You typically don't have conditionals or loops in there. So in those cases, unit tests typically don't make sense. But let's say you're writing bash code and you have conditionals and your if clauses and for loops, then using something like bats definitely makes sense so that you can test those conditionals and loops. Same thing with Chef, you can use Chef spec. Next one up is integration tests. This is pretty crucial, especially where you can provision an ephemeral, like a temporary environment that you can bring down later on, and then run your inspec or Gauss tests, where you can validate things like you're not opening up ports you shouldn't be opening, or you're not exposing your S3 buckets to public and things like that. So you can write some common tests there and then validate that you're passing those tests before deploying your changes to production. And last one at the top is smoke tests with dummy app. The best way to test if your infrastructure was provisioned right is by actually deploying an app that is as close to your actual application that you'll be deploying or your developers will be deploying, and run some smoke tests. So using frameworks like Selenium or JMeter to just validate that your API returns some basic results, or you can load the UI for your web apps, for example. So here's a typical, again, a test pyramid that I have attempted for infrastructure's code testing. Have a look at it, and I would highly encourage to write tests when you're writing your ISE. Security and compliance. These things are often overlooked, but they are very important. So first one up is identity and access management. With infrastructure's code, you definitely have credentials that you need to get access to provision infrastructure on any cloud provider or even on-prem. Make sure that you have proper practices around that. So don't create credentials with admin access so that it can do anything. There are more chances and you're increasing the surface area of attack there. Use practices like RBAC, role-based access control, where you have various roles that allow you to do various things. One easy way here is by your layers. So let's say you're provisioning networking layer, restrict the role that allows you to provision networking layer to only allow networking resources. And then when you're looking at platform layer, create a role that only allows you to provision platform layer. This way, you are reducing the surface area of attack in case your credentials get hacked. Look at practices like that to reduce your risks. Again, like I mentioned, credentials or any other secrets that you need to provision your infrastructure and maintain them long-term. Look at systems like HashiCorp Vault or AWS Secrets Manager. And there are others as well that you can use to store your secrets. Don't store them in plain text, or even Base64 encoded is no good. So look at those secrets management tools, especially HashiCorp Vault is pretty powerful. So look at those to store your secrets. Security scanning allows you to find any vulnerabilities in your ISE code base, but also the infrastructure that you're provisioning. So having that as part of your pipeline that provisions infrastructure helps you to avoids any issues that you might have in production, security issues. So try to include that as part of your pipeline as well. Last but not the least is compliance, and a lot of compliance teams traditionally doing manual checks and gates and doing those towards the end, latter part of the cycle delays things and doesn't help in finding issues faster. So I would recommend looking at tools that allow you to write compliances code. You can do that using Chef Inspect, or even HashiCorp has Sentinel that allows you to write policies code. But definitely consider compliance as one of the important aspects, not just if you're working for healthcare or banking domain. They definitely have more compliance requirements, but having simple requirements like if you're in Europe, GDPR, or even looking at PII, which looks at personally identifiable information, and making sure you have those secure are pretty critical. So all the steps mentioned so far needs to be brought together, and ISE should be executed with appropriate checks in a certain sequence to provision infrastructure with confidence in various environments. For this, let's look at two different options that are typically used. First one is ISE pipeline. This demonstrates a sequence of steps in a pipeline to provision your infrastructure. I have used CircleCI in the example below, but you can use any pipeline tool to execute this. The pipeline provides visibility to everyone who is dependent on the infrastructure that gets provision and notifies appropriate teams when there is a failure. As we can start from the left, a typical continuous integration stage where you run your static analysis and unit tests to get faster feedback. Once those gets passed, you go to the next stage where typically, if you can provision an ephemeral environment is a temporary environment that you provision, run test, and then bring it down. But you can run these things like compliance, integration tests, security, and smoke tests, even in lower environments like dev and QA environment, before you do it in production. So the last step here is provisioning stuff in production, running some smoke tests against your production setup so that you know that you get you are getting what you want, and then validating those. This is a typical ISE pipeline. Next approach to having a shared environment is GitOps, and GitOps is gaining popularity day by day. GitOps is typically taking your infrastructure as code and adding a workflow, which is typically a pull request process that most of the developers are aware of, also adding control loop, which kind of verifies that your desired state and actual state match, and does a loop to confirm that, also notifies the teams if things go out of sync. Let's actually look at a diagram here. So on the left, you start by making your changes, creating a pull request that typically triggers your plan and tests, the fast running tests. Once those passed, it usually gets reviewed by someone within your team or the team that owns the code. They either approve or reject the changes or ask you to make changes. And then eventually those changes get merged. Once those changes get merged, those changes automatically get applied to the appropriate environment. And you can have a step to provision ephemeral environment here as well before you merge the change, or you can even apply changes to various environments using the same flow. Once those changes are applied, you have this control loop that keeps on going, that keeps on verifying that your desired and actual state remain the same. If they go out of sync, then you notify the teams that kind of work on those environments, and also potentially give an option to sync the states. So that's the talk. This talk is based on one of the articles that I wrote on my website. You can go to that using the bit.ly link. And also this article has been included as a chapter to one of the new books that O'Reilly books that came out this year, 97 Things Every Cloud Engineer Should Know. So check the book out as well. There are other great articles in there as well. Yes, that's the talk. Thank you again for listening. My name is Adarsh Shah. I'm an independent consultant. I work with companies of various sizes and domains, help them with digital transformation by help them improve with the, both technical as well as non-technical aspects. And you can find more info about me on my website. Thanks again for listening.